take this opportunity to thank the organizers for inviting me. And, this is actually a very pleasant place to be for a few days. Could have been even more pleasant to have stayed here a little longer, but the thought of actually flying back to Australia on Wednesday doesn't thrill me. It would have been nice to spend a bit longer here.
Why do you do that?
I have to get back to take the family on a holiday. Is that okay? Okay. Right, the title of my talk, which you've all been reading now for the last 5 minutes, refers to how to do quantum error correction for continuously detected errors. My primary motivation for looking at this was to make a connection between what is in fact a rather abstract formulation of quantum error correction as we have it in quantum information theory, very elegant and very powerful, of course, and very important. Were it not for quantum error correction, quantum computing would have remained probably a footnote to modern physics. So I wanted to find if there was some way to connect error correction, which assumes instantaneous projective measurements, among other things, to more practical measurements, which take some time, and to notions of quantum control, in which there is an explicit feedback loop based upon the acquired signal to adjust the future state of the system. That was the general motivation. A more particular motivation was to think about, well, what's the simplest sort of error that we might be able to correct for? Bit flip errors require a minimum of a 3-qubit code, but there is a particular sort of error which does arise in certain quantum computing contexts called a measurement error, where basically you accidentally make a measurement of the qubit halfway through some coherent manipulation, and that of course collapses the state of which, as we've just been discussing. More particularly, it means that you have to update your description of the state so that it is different from what it was before the measurement result was acquired. So these are very simple sorts of errors and can be corrected with a very simple error correction code, so it seemed a good place to start. But they could actually happen. You could imagine some system like this where you have the measurement apparatus always connected, making weak measurements. And even in the quiescent state, there might be some finite probability for the detector to go off and actually record what state a particular qubit was in. That would, of course, be a disaster in an actual quantum computer, but if you could devise a continuously running error correction protocol to fix that, it wouldn't matter. So I'm not aware of any mesoscopic proposal for quantum computing where this would be a problem. Typically, when detectors are off, they are indeed pretty well off. You know, there is a linear optics protocol for quantum computing, however, where it's intrinsic to the protocol that these sorts of errors can occur. That's because the implementation of the gates is based on teleportation, and there's a finite probability that a gate will fail, and it fails in a known way, and that corresponds to making a measurement and having a particular result. So with that motivation, I should have acknowledged my collaborators on this. This was work done in collaboration with Howard Wiseman at Griffith University in Brisbane, who's also part of the Australian Centre for Quantum Computer Technology, and also with Charlene Ahn from John Preskill's group at Caltech, who visited us last year. So this is the outline of the talk. I want to make a very quick summary of the basic ideas in error correction, how errors are related to noise, and also decoherence. Define carefully the sorts of errors I'm going to talk about, which are measurement errors, which could correspond to an ideal measurement where you actually come in and measure sigma z, and find out which of the two logical states the system is in. Closely related to that is something called a spontaneous emission error, which is like a non-ideal measurement of which state the qubit is in. For example, in a two-level atom, if the system decays from the excited state to the ground state and you see the photon, you are sure that the system is in the excited state at the start of that time interval. So they're very closely related. Then I want to introduce the notion of quantum control. To do that, I have to talk about continuous conditional dynamics given a measurement record. This is a bit related to your question at the end of the last talk, where you have a weak continuous measurement, information is coming in, and you may wish to continuously update your description of the quantum system being so interrogated. So it's a kind of continual version of state reduction, but in a fairly weak way. Based on that, I can then talk about quantum feedback, and then finally feedback as error correction. There is a generalization of this to multiple qubits, where you can encode n minus 1 logical qubits in n physical qubits. Other people have discussed this, including this paper by Daniel Lidar, which has a very different approach to what I'm going to consider. But I'm not going to consider the general case. I'll give a reference to the paper where the general case is discussed at the end. So let's begin. This is probably a little bit redundant now, but we've let's just use it to fix note in notation. I'm going to make a distinction between the code states, the logical qubits, and the actual physical qubits that are used to represent the information. In simple two-level systems like a spin system, there's a one-to-one correspondence between the logical state and the actual physical states. But for error correction, you might want to encode the logical information in the states of multiple qubits in terms of correlations between the individual physical qubits. So rather than assuming spin, I'll just take a generic physical qubit and write it as 0 and 1. And if I need to distinguish between physical qubits and logical qubits, I'll put a subscript L on the actual ket. So here's, as we've seen before, a very simple kind of error where the actual physical qubit undergoes an inversion. 0 goes to 1, 1 goes to 0. Of course, this actually happens because the system is interacting with something else, and the record of what has actually happened is, of course, in the other system. If you don't know that, and you average over it, as I'll show in a minute, you get a what's called decoherence. But if you do know what happened in the other system, then you do know what happened in the actual qubit itself, and here it's undergone a bit flip. So instead of writing sigma x for poly, I'll just write capital X, which seems to be the convention in quantum information theory these days. Of course, this can happen for classical bits as well. Something which doesn't happen for classical bits is a phase flip error, where we, at some point in the computation, end up in a superposition of our physical qubits in the computational basis, and the error corresponds to a pi relative phase flip in this superposition state. So that's a phase flip error in this case. What about decoherence? Well, imagine we're in some arbitrary state and we have a phase flip error, and that error occurs with some probability P in a given trial, and we have many trials, and we wish to describe the ensemble of all those trials, so we would need to average over all the possible events of flip and no flip to the phase. Then the density matrix that would describe that ensemble is given by this expression here, where you see the diagonal terms, the probabilities to be in 0 and 1 are unchanged by a phase flip error, as you would expect, but the coherence term can be suppressed. When P is equal to 0, of course, there's no error and all the coherence remains. When P is equal to 1, there's also no decoherence, because then every system in every trial undergoes a phase flip, and if you start in a pure state and everyone's had a phase flip, then the ensemble is still described by a pure state. But at P equals a half, where there's 50-50 chance of a phase flip or not a phase flip, then you lose the coherence in this case. So that connects this rather abstract notion of an error induced by a poly operator to decoherence. So now let me introduce Z measurement errors, which are not often discussed in quantum error correction. Suppose that somewhere during the calculation the qubit ended up in a superposition of the logical states with amplitude alpha for 0 and beta for 1, and an ideal measurement of Z is made, by which I mean a quantum non-demolition measurement, if you like, or a perfect projection measurement, one in which the outcome is known with certainty. So if the Z measurement error gives result 0, then the conditional state of the system conditioned on that result is indeed 0. If the Z measurement error gives result 1, then the conditional state conditioned on that result is indeed 1 with certainty. These, of course, will occur with relative probabilities mod alpha squared and mod beta squared. If, however, you repeat this many times and you don't know what the actual result of the measurement is, but you know it's taken place, then the ensemble, then the density operator which would describe those trials would be this diagonal density operator in the computational basis. So in many ways, this sort of decoherence is very much like the phase flip error. And indeed, the phase flip can be considered as a kind of minimal amount of back action that would occur if you tried to make a Z measurement error of this kind. And Dimitri just gave in the last talk an example of the sort of interaction that you would need to do this. It would be a ZZ type interaction. So that's an ideal Z measurement. Mostly I'm going to be talking about a non-ideal Z measurement error, or spontaneous emission. So here, the conditional state of the system is quite different, because the actual Krauss operator, the operator that tells you how to calculate the conditional state, is not a projection operator, It's actually this operator here, which takes the system from state 1 to state 0. So if a system is in state 0, nothing happens, but if it's in state 1, in a sense you get a click on the detector that says, yes, it was in state 1, but the conditional state is different. The probability of getting that result 1, or that click, is of course just given by trace of A dagger A in the usual formulation of quantum measurement, but it's obviously just mod beta squared, as you would expect, because that's the probability that the system was indeed in state 1. So the difference between this and the ideal Z measurement that I was considering before is that here the conditional state is different to what it was in the ideal case. For a two-level system, however, they provide just as much information about what state the system was in before the measurement was made. So how would you correct a measurement of this kind? Well, this is the reason I'm discussing it, because a very simple code can be used to correct a so-called a non-ideal Z measurement error, or even an ideal Z measurement error. But let's just consider this spontaneous emission example. So suppose the error occurred on the first qubit and it is detected. Now we have to assume that we know which qubit gave the result to get away with such a simple code. But let's suppose the first qubit error is detected, then this state is acted upon by this lowering operator, A sub 1 for the first qubit, and it takes us to alpha 0, 1 plus beta 0, 0. The important point is alpha and beta still remain in this expression. So the quantum information, if you like, has not been lost as a result of this measurement. More importantly, the probability of the measurement of the error, or the measurement, is in fact 1/2 and is now independent of the state of the system, which is good. And that can easily be corrected via this unitary operator here, acting on the total system. You can work it out for yourself. But the basic idea is, in some sense, these are parity eigenstates. They live in two different parity sectors. And so I can always find an operator that rotates this one back into this sector and this one back into this sector. And you can check it through and work out what the other unitary operators are. Basically, they're the same as this, with I and X interchanged and possibly a plus or minus sign inserted there. So this is the standard picture of how to correct for errors. Something happens. In this case, it's a very special sort of error. It's a detected measurement error, or a detected spontaneous emission error. And then once we know that's happened, we then act back on the system, back on the conditional state, conditioned on the result of the measurement, to fix up, to restore the system back to the logical basis. Okay. I want to now switch track and talk about errors that occur continuously in time. Bill?
Question. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are really just spin flip errors, aren't they? I mean,
no, they're not a spin flip.
Slightly different language.
No. One goes to zero, but zero stays at zero. So zero doesn't go to one. Let me just backtrack a little bit. It's not a spin flip because it has X minus IY appearing in here. So
you don't understand. You've got one Krauss operator, but this is a measurement with two possible different outcomes. There'll be two Krauss operators to do.
That's just the complementary one to this. The conditional state, if you don't get a click, is zero. It's a little bit easy to see that in the continuous case. Where was I? Okay. So now I want to imagine these errors, or measurements, or spontaneous emission, whatever you like to call them, occur continuously in time, and in particular at Poisson distributed times. So they're not occurring at some average rate, but at random time. So I'll define a Poisson process, which is the increment in some count in time dt. It's either 0 or 1, which is what this says. And if I do a classical ensemble average over this, I get the rate of the Poisson process times the time interval dt. So let's imagine now we have some system which is undergoing a bit flip error at Poisson distributed times, and we'd like to write down a master equation to describe the dynamics of the qubit, given that the bit flip errors are happening, but we don't know when they're happening. So we're going to calculate the change in the state of system between t and t plus dt, which is obviously given by this expression. Two things can happen. Either a bit flip can occur, and that occurs with probability gamma dt. So this fraction here of the original ensemble undergoes a bit flip, but there's a possibility that no bit flip happened, which occurs with probability 1 minus gamma dt, and then the system state is unchanged, and then I just subtract rho t off from both sides to form the increment and divide through by dt, and I get this very simple master equation here, which describes the evolution of the qubit given that the bit flip errors are occurring at Poisson distributed times. It has a very simple form because x is unitary, so x squared is the identity, so we just have rho t appearing here. So we're going to describe continuous errors through a master equation of this kind. What happens for spontaneous emission error? We need a slightly more sophisticated treatment. Once again, we'll assume they occur at Poisson distributed times. However, now, in a sense, they're conditional Poisson processes because they have to be conditioned on the instantaneous state of the qubit because it depends upon whether or not the system is in state 1. So the probability, as always, for the spontaneous emission or this non-ideal measurement to give a result 1, click, yes, it's in state 1, between times t and t plus dt is gamma, average value of a dagger a at that time times dt. Now, the way to describe this is in terms of these modified Krauss operators, which take account of the fact that this is a Poisson process. So there's some Krauss operator, which I'll call a jump operator, which describes what happens to the system when a spontaneous emission event occurs or a measurement occurs. And here's the no-jump operator that you were asking about a little while ago. It's basically the identity minus the complement of that. But there's an important point here which I'll come to. And I've also put in a Hamiltonian term here because that will become extremely important in what follows and how to correct for spontaneous emission errors. Now, when you plug this into the master equation, here's the increment again. Here's that fraction of, I've left off a zero, that fraction of the ensemble that has not undergone a jump, the fraction of the ensemble that has undergone a jump. By jump, I mean spontaneous emission or result of measurement. And when you plug these in, this is the description you get. So this is the master equation. The background for this formalism can be found in this paper by Howard Wiseman. Now, this is a little bit different to just bit flip errors because this is not a unitary operator. Before, I just had x rho, x minus rho. But now I get a dagger rho, a rho a dagger minus this thing here. Now, this is telling you that even if you're not detecting a measurement result, the state of the system must be changing, because if you start it off and you wait a very long time and you don't see a click, then you can be more and more certain that the system is not in state 1. So if you start off with a complete ignorance about the initial state, you must gradually become more certain, if you never see a detection event, that the system was indeed in state 0. And that kind of null conditioning is taken care of by this term here. This is the conditioning that happens when you actually see a measurement result or a jump or a click on your detector. Okay, so let me just stress this point. There are two completely different ways, although complementary, of thinking about the effect of measurement in quantum mechanics, and this is perhaps much more important in the continuous case than in the discrete case. We can talk about what is the state of the measured system given a record of all the measurement results. So here we're asking a kind of conditional question, a Bayesian question, if you like. How do I continuously update my description of the system given a record or a complete trial, a set of results of all the trials up to time t? So that will be the conditional dynamics. Or I can average over all possible results. The measurement's taking place, something's going on, but I have no idea what the results are. That would be the unconditional dynamics. And the master equation I just described describes the unconditional dynamics because I've summed over the possibilities for jump and no jump. But now I actually want to go on and describe what happens to the system if I actually have a record of the measurement result. So what does it mean in this case for Poisson distributed jumps or measurements or spontaneous emissions? Well, it means I have a complete history of the times at which every result was recorded. That is as fine-grained as it can get for this system. I could average over all the times and just record the total number of jumps, but I'm going to go further and suppose I have this complete record of information. Then it must be the case that if the system starts in a pure state, and I have all this information, then it will all, the conditional state must always be a pure state for all time, because there's no coarse graining involved at all. Which means, of course, that in a small time interval, I don't need to write down an evolution equation for the density operator, I can write down a stochastic evolution equation for the actual state of the system.
I'm a little confused here, because after you see a jump, you know the state of the system, so and it's not going to change again, is it?
Well, it could if there's a Hamiltonian. That's an important point. And indeed, in a quantum computer, it would, because there's some processing going on. Okay. So it turns out that this equation here is the appropriate way to describe the conditional, continual dynamics of the state, given that the measurement record is always being accumulated perfectly and there's no loss of information. If you form from this the derivative of the exterior product of the conditional state and average over the noise process dn, you get exactly the same master equation that I wrote down on the previous slide that describes the unconditional dynamics, which is what this expression here says. This is a classical average over this classical conditional Poisson process. So now we have everything in place to define feedback. Because we actually have the measurement record, it's this Poisson process. The way to describe feedback is then to imagine I have a Hamiltonian which depends upon, in this case linearly, upon the current of measurement records. Now this is highly singular, of course. In reality, this would be convolved with some response function to smooth out these delta function peaks at Poisson distributed times. But let's just stick with this simple case where now I just have, basically this is zero if no jump occurs, and this is V when the jump occurs, and I'm going to insert this conditional Hamiltonian into the conditional Schrödinger equation, and then imagine I average over all possible results, so I'm going to describe a free-running closed-loop feedback system. Well, if you take account of the fact that this feedback must always act after the measurement, and it's important to put that in when you don't have a response function in here, then average over all measurement records, this is the now the new master equation which describes the dynamics of the system. It's pretty much the same as before. I've used a notation here where this super operator D is the same as before, but now there's this finite unitary change due to the act of feedback at each jump that is inserted in the system. However, there are many other ways of doing this, or as we say, unraveling the master equation, because once the jumps come out, I can do further signal processing, if I wish, on that signal. And it's often the case that the jumps are coming so thick and fast that, in a sense, no detector can sensibly respond to those. And what one then does is approximate a Poisson process with a diffusion process and write down a different kind of stochastic Schrödinger equation to describe what's going on. So here I'll imagine that the actual operator which determines the detection events is not A itself, but A plus some finite quantity alpha. In quantum optics, this would describe Hermodyne detection of a field. In mesoscopic physics, this sort of thing tends to happen very naturally in a quantum point contact, where typically there'd be a large background current always present, and the actual effect of the measurement would be some finite change sitting on top of that. In that case, it might be better to describe the system via some diffusive process over the rather than every individual jump and keep a record of that history. I won't go through the technical details here, it's not too important. The important point to note, however, is that I get a completely different conditional description of the dynamics when I do this, which now involves this operator. This is a nonlinear super operator. The reason it's nonlinear is precisely because this is conditional. That is, the future must depend upon observations in the past in an essential way. There's a noise term in here which will turn off whenever the system tends toward an eigenstate of A, because there are actually no eigenstates of A, but you can get pretty close to it. Then this term would cancel this term and the noise would turn off. And so this represents localization of the system on some particular state near eigenstate of the measured operator. Anyway, the important point here to note is that now my signal is this current here, which is basically the increment in the number of jumps minus this very large background rate, which I didn't really care about. Actually, I've just realized that should be alpha, not gamma at this point. So we subtract off this constant background rate, then we normalize by the size of the background rate, and we define this new signal current, which now is a diffusion process. It's a smooth process. We've essentially smoothed out the jumps by taking this very large limit. Then once again, the feedback can be included by modulating a Hamiltonian with this current, and now I average over all possible measurement records and I get a new description of the conditional dynamics of the system involving the feedback operator and the actual measurement operators in an essential way. And this is the same superoperator that I had before that describes the jumps, but now it's shifted by the feedback operator. Because I've averaged over all current records, so this is the unconditional dynamics, which must be linear in this case. So because I have no record, there's no sense of conditional future dependent upon the past. Here. So here now it must be linear at this point. Well, of course, in general, feedback wouldn't be Markovian and linear in this fashion. By assuming the kind of white noise and Poisson distributed and instantaneous response that I've done, I've made the whole thing Markovian. I've sort of swept away all those assumptions here, but you can check the original work to see where those go in. So now let's look at jump detection. Let me just remind you, these were the code words for jump detection or spontaneous emission detection or non-ideal measurement detection. In a sense, in the sort of theory of error correction, the stabilizer here is XX, and as I said before, an error on the first qubit takes you to these states. These are the two unitary transformations we need to apply in the standard model of error correction, where things happen at discrete times with instantaneous readout. But now I want to build this into the feedback mechanism to have the whole thing running continuously. So that's easy to do. I just modify my, here's my Krauss jump operator written out explicitly in terms of the Pauli matrices now. And when I put in, here's the master equation. Given that the measurements are taking place on both qubits, 1 and 2, at random times, that's omega 1. This is omega naught, which describes what happens when no jumps are being observed. And I've included a Hamiltonian term. So now when I put in the effect of feedback, well, let me first point out a very important point that we noted when we were doing this. Firstly, we have to both correct the effect of the jumps and we have to correct the effect of no jumps. Because, as I said before, not seeing a jump, not seeing a measurement result, is just as good a piece of information that tells you the system really wasn't in state one after all. It turns out you can easily correct for that just by adding a driving Hamiltonian to the no-jump operator. When you plug that in, you can rewrite the no-jump operator so that the key thing that appears is II minus XX, which acts as zero on the code space, because XX is the stabilizer for this code. So this acts trivially on the code space. I just get an overall state-independent renormalization, which doesn't affect the state. So I can fix the no-jump terms in a suitable driving Hamiltonian. So it looks kind of odd. It means you have to modify the dynamics intrinsically right from the start to correct for the no-jump terms. The jump terms are easy to correct. I just need to insert these unitary operators conditional upon the actual jump itself and then average over all the results. And it's easy to show that this also preserves the code space, but it's kind of trivial because the unitaries I was inserting always just restore me back to the code space. Yep.
Does correction in this case or stabilization mean that you preserve the state or you cause the state to evolve only under the internal Hamiltonian that you assumed?
Any state in the code space, if there's no intrinsic dynamics, just stays there completely protected. In a sense, what you're doing is if it tries to move out of the code space, this is pushing it back in. And it does it so that an arbitrary state goes back to an arbitrary state. I'm not sure whether you're asking whether there's any more dynamics going on there.
There was a dynamic inside the code space. This is also undisturbed.
Yes, completely. Because that non-jump operator is just zero on the code space. That's correct. No, it's not that. That is, in some sense, the work that Charlene Arne did with Andrew Landau, where they had a more complicated feedback process. But in this case, it's much simpler. Likewise, in the case where the jump rates are coming thick and fast and you need to use a diffusion description to describe what's going on, we just choose the feedback operators once again to be these unitaries which restore the code space. And now the master equation looks like this, and trivially we see that these things act as zero on the code space, because I can always rewrite these things as ii minus xx, ii minus xx, and which annihilates the code space. So on the code space, rho dot is zero. Even though the errors are always happening, and even though you have this feedback Hamiltonian on, basically there is no dynamics. So let me come to the conclusion. By restricting myself to this very special case of detected spontaneous emission errors or detected non-ideal measurement errors, I've shown that they can be corrected continuously. It also works perfectly well for ideal Z measurements of the kind I described early on, where if you measure 0, the conditional state is 0, and if you measure 1, the conditional state is 1. It works just as well for that. These spontaneous emission errors, as I've tried to indicate at the beginning, could correspond to accidental non-ideal Z measurement errors. So if for some reason your measurement apparatus halfway through a computation suddenly accidentally made a measurement, if you didn't have an error correction protocol like this running, all bets are off and you've got to go back and start again. But this could protect against that. I'm not suggesting this is a practical idea. Although as a kind of simple little testbed for quantum error correction, I think this has some merit. We could, for example, implement this using our scheme for two phosphorus qubits implanted in silicon with RF single electron transistors running side by side with a closed loop feedback protocol. There'd be lots of practical problems to overcome about response time and all the rest of it, inefficiencies in the measurement, which I've just swept under the carpet here. But in principle, one could do it. So the feedback can correct for these measurement errors, also applies to non-ideal measurement errors. And this can be generalized to the case of n qubits, where now you can encode n minus 1 logical states in n qubits and detect and protect against detected spontaneous emission error on any single qubit. It's the formalism goes through pretty much the same. It's a little bit closer to the description of standard error correction once you generalize it to the n qubit case, and the details can be found in this paper on the archive. So with that, I'll finish and welcome any questions. Thank you.
Questions?
Tony?
I think I might miss the point here. Suppose we take as a specific example of a qubit, an atom with the ground state and the excited state.
Yes.
So you have to start off with some kind of non-trivial density matrix of off-diagonal,
mm-hmm.
etc.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a spontaneous emission process, and you work out how the density matrix changes as a result.
Yes.
Now, I think this is a bit misunderstood. Are you claiming that I can now do an operation which involves simply on the atom itself and restore the original density matrix?
Yes. The point you missed is you have to go to the two physical qubit code in order for it to work. You can't do it with just one atom, because once the spontaneous emission happens, that's the end of the show, basically. But by encoding the logical qubits in a minimum of two physical qubits, even though the spontaneous emission takes place, you still haven't lost the coherent information. In a sense, your state has just jumped out of the code space into some other dimension, and the idea then is to restore it unitarily back to the code space. Oh, now I was worried about this. Because I'm using this word spontaneous emission, it sort of strongly suggests there's a photon somewhere. And I said detected spontaneous emission. So the photon was indeed detected. That was the click. And not only was it detected, it has to tell you which qubit, physical qubit, it actually came from. So this only works, you can only get away with this low-dimensional code if you know the jump has happened and you know which qubit jumped. If you don't know that, then you've got to go back to a five-dimensional code. And I haven't worked out how one would do that with continuous feedback. Three? Sorry. Three if you just want to correct for spontaneous emission. Yeah.
Okay. In your process, I mean, the jump immediately gives the information about the system. I mean, do you think it's possible to generalize this when
That can be incorporated under the notion of an inefficient measurement, where basically there's an extra level of coarse graining that goes on. The jump has occurred, the measurement apparatus in a sense has recorded it, but might forget it with some probability before you get a chance to actually read it out. you can adapt this process to describe what goes on there, so long as the inefficiency isn't too big. If the inefficiency gets too big, the feedback is just adding noise to the system and making matters worse. But there's a constraint on the degree of efficiency and the strength of the feedback that you would have to satisfy to make it work.